You're listening to MLB.com Extras, brought to you by MLB.tv. It's baseball everywhere.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to MLB.com Extras, where we're talking American League East. We're talking about the imminent division champion Baltimore Orioles, who are at the point where they can start lining up and looking in October, but they're also dealing with a pretty significant loss with Chris Davis suspended due to a drug violation. The Blue Jays and Yankees are trying to cling to the fringes of wild card contention. The Rays are still trying to get back to 500, and the Red Sox are still trying to take a look at all their various pieces as to what the 2015 Red Sox will look like, while also maybe taking a little delight in being a spoiler. We'll be talking to all five MLB.com American League East beat writers here on MLB.com Extras. Thanks for listening. Talking Baltimore Orioles with MLB.com's Orioles beat reporter, Brittany Giroli. Brittany, looked for a while like this might be a coronation run here and a kind of a fun, happy, everything sunny run down the stretch, but I guess that's really not the way the Orioles do things. It's never entirely easy. With the suspension of Chris Davis, I think the first thing, and I know he hasn't talked much, he may not be able to shed much light on this just yet, but what's your understanding of just kind of the sequence of events that leads to a guy who did have an exemption getting suspended?
Yeah, I wish I could give you a timeline of events. We really don't have one. Not a whole lot of information about when his first test was, when the exemption was. Any of that really has come out at all. There's been a lot of speculation, a lot of conflicting reports, but no one knows for sure. And I think until Chris Davis comes out and tells his side of the story at length instead of issuing a statement, we're really not going to know what led to this.
What, for the time being, what's his plan? I know we know a little of this. What's his plan to stay sharp and to try and make sure that he is ready if there is an opportunity to play for the Orioles again in 2014?
Well, he talked to manager Buck Showalter yesterday, and the plan is for him to head down probably at some point this week to the team spring facility in Sarasota, Florida. They have instructional leave going on there. He is allowed to play in those games. They had to check on his availability, but Major League Baseball will allow that. So he's been working out. He'll stay ready. Now, the real question to me is, because his suspension is postseason applicable, you're looking at if the Orioles' first round goes smoothly and say they don't go to five games, it really changes whether or not you want to play a man down and have Chris Davis there. I mean, if you play three games as opposed to five, obviously Chris Davis has to sit out those eight games in the postseason. So could he be a factor in that second round? Is going to be a big decision that if they get there, manager Buck Showalter is going to have to make, because it's my understanding they'd have to play with 24 until Davis is activated. And keep in mind, he didn't have a great offensive season when this was going on. So people have talked about this loss like it's a big deal, when in effect, his WAR right now is, which is wins above replacement, is right in between Caleb Joseph, rookie catcher, and Jonathan Scope, their rookie second baseman. So he hasn't really been that guy for them all year. This is certainly a blow because he can't be around the team as well. He was a big presence in there, but it's not quite the panic that I think people maybe associate with it from the outside.
And you kind of hit on this. This may be getting ahead of ourselves, but do you think there's any question at all, if they got to a point, say if they were got to the World Series, or if it were only three games in the LCS, is there any way that they decide that things are working better without him, even if the math adds up?
Of course. I think there's definitely that way. You look at kind of the way they've done things all year, the way guys have stepped up all year. Steve Pierce is a great example. Kelly Johnson last night with a walk-off double wouldn't be playing if Chris Davis was here right now. So I think that they're going to evaluate that based on how the team is playing and where they are in terms of games played when they get to that second round. And then they'll kind of go from there. There's certainly nothing guaranteed to Chris Davis at this point in time.
It is an interesting situation in a lot of ways, because you mentioned his clubhouse presence, and it's certainly my understanding he's a really well-regarded guy in there. And it's also my understanding that that's a club that in particular really – they feel like a big part of what they do is that sort of that vibe in the room. Do you think his standing in that room changes any? Do you think they make a decision based on needing him, the person on the roster? How do they kind of add all that up? Again, with the acknowledgement that we are kind of putting the cart ahead of the horse, because they're not in the NLCS yet. But how does his place sort of in the clubhouse vibe change, or does it as a result of this?
I think it does a little bit. I think guys use the word shocked a lot to describe what's going on. And I think when you look at what happened and the fact that it was self-inflicted, it's different than an injury. It's not something that was unavoidable by any means. So I think it does change his standing a little bit in that clubhouse. Guys were obviously a little bit more upset than they wanted to publicly let on. But I think there was a big sigh of relief because of what the test was for. It wasn't for any kind of PED. He wasn't trying to bulk up to hit some more home runs. And I think that anyone who kind of sees this as a reason to negate last season, well, he was tested a lot last season, and we know he didn't have that exemption last year. So clearly, Chris Davis really didn't use anything last year that gave him any kind of advantage that we know of that is tested right now. But I think when you talk about Chris Davis, he's a guy who was so adamant last year during his historic campaign about the fact that MLB's drug policy has kind of clouded some of the records. He was very open, very outspoken about it. And I think if you're going to do that, you have to make sure, regardless of what the infraction is, that you are within the letter of the law, that you are abiding by that drug policy, if you're going to attach your name to such strong words as he did last year. And I think that's part of what really got to some of his teammates in there. And I'm not saying that anyone is going to not welcome him back with open arms, because I think they will. But I think this certainly kind of lessened maybe the opinion of some of the younger players, maybe lessened his role a little bit as a role model for some of those guys going forward.
What do they do? It seems like Kelly Johnson is a guy whose role will increase the most. Does he sort of become essentially a full-time guy?
Yes, he does, in my opinion. He's played pretty much every day over the – I know it's been a really short sample size since this happened, but he's been their guy. I expect him to be their guy. It's funny because him and Alejandro Daza, two guys who weren't on this team a month ago, are now two guys who you would expect to be on that postseason roster. So those are typical Dan Duquette type of trades. They're under the radar. Nobody really bats an eyelash. It barely registered a blip in the baseball world. It was small even here in Baltimore, and they were the team that was obviously getting those two players. So, when you look at what they've been able to do, this is just two more small pieces that fit in that larger puzzle for Showalter to manipulate around and use to his advantage. And both of those guys have fit in real well there. They've given him a lift. And Kelly Johnson said yesterday that, this feels like a club that's kind of just on a track for destiny. He said, they were down that one run last night in the ninth inning, and they always felt like they had a chance to win. He said he hasn't been a part of something like this in his career, and he feels like this is a team that finds ways to win instead of finds ways to lose. And I think there's something to be said for that and for the culture that was created. When you bring in these smaller, marginal players and you give them an opportunity, I think it only fosters that. These guys are playing for their postseason roster spot. They're playing to prove everybody wrong. The Orioles, even though they have an 11.5-game lead, still very much have a chip on their shoulders. They know they're not the team that's going to get all the national attention. And Buck does a very good job of feeding into that and making sure that they keep that mentality that their backs are up against the wall.
Yeah, you kind of lead into my next question. I want to be very careful how I phrase this, because obviously anybody in the clubhouse, in the coaching staff, in the front office would rather have Davis. They'd rather have Machado. They'd rather have Wieters. But do you get the impression that on some level Buck Showalter kind of enjoys the challenge, enjoys the chip on the shoulder? It just reminds me, I covered a guy who reveled in that stuff. Tony La Russa was at his best when there were moving parts, when he had to manage, and when there was kind of a purpose. Do you get that impression that even if he didn't like how they got there, that Buck Showalter really kind of enjoys the way this team shakes down right now?
Absolutely. I think I get what you're saying. Yes, he'd rather have those guys, and he'd feel better about penciling those names into the lineup. But Buck has always loved the Steve Pierces of the world, the guys who just go out there and battle and will be fighting for their roster spot probably their entire career. Those have always been Buck guys, not necessarily the superstars. And he's done a good job since he got here of kind of weeding out the players who weren't part of a team atmosphere, who were self-centered, who were more concerned with their arbitration numbers than they were with the team's win-loss record. So this is a team that I think Buck enjoys being a part of, enjoys managing. And this is a team that really doesn't have any ego at all. When you look at some of their bigger players, J.J. Hardy, Nick Markakis, Adam Jones, they really just set an example every day, wanting to be in that lineup. They're guys who really influence the way that clubhouse is structured.
I'll kind of go big picture here a minute. For you've been in Baltimore for several years now, and for people of a certain age, that's one of those places we really think of as a great baseball city and a place with a great history and where the organization means something. And so I know the players just want to clinch and get in wherever they can. But for the city, for the organization, to clinch a division title at home, as it looks like there's every reason to think they'll do, how big a deal is that around the city and around the organization?
It's huge. I think people forget that in 2012 they didn't get to celebrate. They were on a plane when they found out that they had won. They kind of backed in a little bit. They won because of a loss, the Angels-Rangers game. And that plane actually had a mini fire and had to emergency land to Jacksonville. So there wasn't a whole lot of celebrating there for them at all. They didn't get to celebrate at home. They did win that wild card game and got to celebrate in Arlington. But these fans at Camden Yards have never seen a division clinch at home. The last time the Orioles won a division with a win here in Baltimore was 1969. So it goes without saying that none of the current Orioles players were alive. It's been a huge drought for the city. And you're right, man, they have every chance to do it. They could do it as soon as tomorrow night and really set themselves up well for the playoffs. So this whole city is invigorated. The games over the weekend felt like postseason games here. Baltimore feels like they're on the map. It's really their year with the American League East. And it's exciting to see, as you mentioned, one of baseball's best cities, best fan base around, really come to life the last couple of years.
Cool. Well, all right. Well, Brittany Giroli, thanks for taking a few minutes here to chat on MLB.com Extras. Talking Toronto Blue Jays with MLB.com's Blue Jays beat reporter, Gregor Chisholm. Gregor, it wouldn't be the Blue Jays if we didn't have one more twist in the last 2 weeks. And suddenly, after the Jays looking like they were in an awfully deep hole, they're right back in it. What do you make of the math? Just you looking at this team and the schedule and the standings, what do you make of the math with a little less than 2 weeks to go for this club?
Yeah, you know, it's this season, as you said, it's just been full of so many twists. You know, it seems like every time that, you know, people are about to write this team off, they find a way to get back into it. And every time it looks like they're going to make a strong push, then they seem to follow that up with a struggle. You know, as it looks right now, there really just isn't any margin for error. You know, time is obviously running out. They've put themselves in a position where they have an outside chance, but in a lot of ways, they don't control their own fate. I mean, it's a good thing for this team that they have an upcoming series against the Mariners next week. That could be very, very crucial for this organization. But then you're also going to have either one of Detroit or Kansas City that you're chasing for that second wild card spot as well. So they're going to need some help. But in order to do this, they don't have to completely run the table, but they can really probably only lose a couple of games the rest of the way to realistically put themselves in the conversation for potentially being able to kind of steal the second wild card spot this late into the year.
I know that to some extent what a big league club does is take care of today's business and not really get too caught up in the standings and in what happened yesterday. But do you sense any kind of difference in the vibe in the clubhouse now that they have gone from, in the last really 2 weeks, from a 500 team looking very much on the fringes and on the cusp of maybe falling out of it to a team that really has as good a shot as nearly anybody except those top three clubs in this wild card race?
Yeah, you know, there really has been. You know, there inside that clubhouse, I think there were some guys that looked at this about a month ago to, you know, during that really tough stretch that they had in August and towards the end of August, and were really, you know, looking around and watching everything kind of slip away. There was that feeling inside there. In the last couple of weeks, the way that they've recovered in September has kind of given everybody a little bit of renewed hope. There was a couple of really tough losses in Boston where they had leads late in the game and weren't able to come away with those. Those are really costly wins, and that kind of brought back that, you know, sense of discouragement, I think. But they were able to bounce back right after that. So, I think there is hope. Everybody, I think, inside that clubhouse realizes that it's an outside chance, but they've developed a little bit of swagger, which is something that we had seen from this team, much earlier in the season, especially in May, but even when things started to struggle a little bit in June and July, there was still that swagger. That was definitely missing for all of August, and there were some serious question marks about whether that confidence would ever come back, but it has. It's just a matter of right now whether that's a little bit too late to actually mean something, but they're making things interesting.
We talked last week about the change in center field. Between the removal of Colby Rasmus as the center fielder and the loss of Melky Cabrera for the year, how are things working out for that outfield right now?
Yeah, that's I was fully expecting Rasmus to get another shot at starting, but I kind of thought with the fact that the Blue Jays would kind of continue with the platoon of Kevin Pillar and Anthony Gose, that didn't end up being the case. John Gibbons came out pretty much right away when Melky Cabrera got hurt and said their plan hasn't changed. They want to see what these young kids can do, and that means giving regular playing time to Pillar and Gose. Rasmus did make a start during the weekend series against the Rays, but that was the first time he had started a game in a couple of weeks. So he really has been buried on that bench and has kind of been just used as a left-handed power bat, pinch hitter late in games. And that paid off with a couple of very key and very important home runs for that team. But, it's an interesting move because Kevin Pillar typically struggles against right-handers. I would have thought that they would have gone to Colby a little bit more in that situation, but it's kind of another indication that this team really has turned the page on Rasmus and is looking to the future even while they're trying to keep an eye on the present at the same time.
While we're updating past topics, how are things working in the bullpen? It seems like there are some things going really well and maybe some things that aren't perfectly sorted out just yet.
Yeah, I think there's finally some clarity, which is something that was really lacking for a couple of weeks. I think Casey Jansen had a really difficult time knowing exactly what his role was. He was the closer. He wasn't the closer. He was kind of a part-time guy. It's clear that Aaron Sanchez is the priority down there, but they're still really keeping an eye on making sure to pick their spots with him. There's going to be times where he's going to go two innings and then not be available for a day or two, and then Jansen's going to settle back into that role. So it's almost like, we spend some time with the platoon of Pillar and Gose. Well, in a lot of sense, the Blue Jays are going with a platoon at closer. And it's an attempt to keep everybody fresh. Jansen's still going to get his opportunities. Sanchez is definitely going to get some opportunities in there as well. And I think it took a little while for everyone just to kind of understand when Sanchez would be used. And now that that's become a little bit more clear, when he's available, he's going to be used. I think it's helped everybody just settle in and know a little bit what to expect, because when it comes to those bullpen arms, there is something to be said for stability down there and guys knowing exactly what type of situations they're going to be used. So I think they have figured that out. It took a little bit longer than they would have liked, but I think the final couple of weeks they know what to expect.
Sanchez is an interesting guy. Really, for a lot of his career, the numbers haven't exactly matched the hype. And this year in the minors, he was, again, numbers-wise, having an okay year, but walking more than a guy every two innings, the strikeout rate wasn't that high. I mean, again, numbers aren't everything, especially in the minors, but the numbers really weren't great. He gets to the majors, makes a transition to the bullpen, and the numbers are ridiculous. He's been dominant. Is it just as simple as grip it and rip it? Is there some difference in what he's doing in his repertoire? What's the difference between Aaron Sanchez, minor league starter, and Aaron Sanchez, big league reliever?
What's really going to be interesting with him is when he does eventually go back to that starting role next year. The way he struggled earlier this season in the minor leagues and last year as well, when he had to go through a lineup multiple times, that's when he really had a lot of difficulty. And a lot of that was related to command as well. But, hitters were having a little bit more success after that, third, fourth inning, after guys had seen him a little bit. And that's a luxury when you're pitching in the bullpen that other teams don't have. He can just come in, be aggressive. Guys are only going to get one brief look at him. And in a lot of cases, he's facing these teams for the first time. So, he really does have overpowering stuff. So it makes a lot of sense as to why he's had success. The one thing that I think is going to be very interesting for him is how he deals with teams after they've seen him a little bit. When he gets into that starting role next year, when he has to go through a lineup 2-3 times in a particular game, whether or not he's able to make adjustments after hitters make adjustments to him. That hasn't been something that he's really been able to do on a consistent basis in the minor leagues, but he's going to have to do it at the major league level. And, you know, that's going to be a really big key for him moving forward. But when it comes to pure stuff, you know, he's about as good as it gets. And it's whether or not he can take that next step and really prove that he's not just a bullpen arm, just not a potential closer of the future, but he's a guy who could be a frontline starter. And that's what the Blue Jays ultimately hope that he can become.
Yeah, I'm a really big believer that a good starter is more valuable than really even a great reliever, that the value in a legitimate quality starter who can give you 190, 200, 210 innings is enormous. With that said, if this guy has these issues starting, again, he's developing, he's young, if he has these issues starting, and if he shows himself to be a consistently dominant reliever, has the conversation begun at all within the organization about whether his future is maybe different than they thought it was?
Not yet. I wouldn't expect that for a little bit longer. I think that at the very least they give him all of next season, whether or not part of that includes some time, more time in the minor leagues, or whether it's a full year at the big league level kind of remains to be seen. But I think they're fully committed to him as a starter right now. And, you know, on top of that, you know, maybe there's something to be said for the confidence that he's currently gaining at the big league level as well. I mean, it's something that we used to see a lot of teams do where they start guys, they bring them into the bullpen to make their debuts, get some experience, get their feet wet, and then kind of go from a starting role after that. Not as many teams, a lot of teams still do it, but not quite as many as there used to be. But it'll be interesting to see if this kind of changes his psyche a little bit as well, because a big thing with him is being aggressive with his, you know, dominating fastball and really attacking the zone instead of trying to nibble and lose command that way. You know, now he knows he's been up here. He's had a nice, successful run now for a couple of months at the big league level. By the time this year comes to an end, whether he's able to kind of build on that this offseason and really know that he belongs in the big leagues, and whether that changes his mentality. But, you know, I think the Blue Jays organization has the same mentality that you do, that they would really prioritize the innings as a starter over bullpen. And, you know, it's possible that conversation will change a year or two from now, but they're fully committed to this development of him as hopefully being a number one, number two, number three type guy for multiple years going forward.
Gregor Chisholm, thanks for taking some time here to talk on MLB.com Extras, talking New York Yankees with MLB.com's Yankees beat reporter, Brian Hoke. Brian, it's been an up and down for the Yankees, and lately things are looking a little disappointing, but there seems to be some good news. Masahiro Tanaka is maybe going to pitch. Is he going to pitch in a major league game? Where does that stand right now?
It seems like there's a very good chance of that. Through 65 pitches in a simulated game at George M. Steinbrenner Field yesterday. That's a big step. You know, he got hit around a little bit, but that's not really what concerns the Yankees. What they're looking for is that he comes through healthy, the velocity's good. He maxed out at 92 miles an hour yesterday. And pitching coach Larry Rothschild said it's pretty close to what they saw in the first half before he got hurt in July. I think for Tanaka's own peace of mind, it's important that he gets back on the mound. I think you don't want to – he's going to obviously fly home to Japan and have the whole winter to work out and rest. You don't want to have that lingering in the back of your mind the entire winter. Can I get back on the mound? Can I face a major league team? So I think even if he just comes back for one start, it looks like it's not going to help the Yankees push toward the postseason. But I think that if he can come back and get major league hitters out before he heads home, I think that is good for his own peace of mind.
You may have just answered this question, actually, but – the last time we talked about this, it sounded like they were being awfully conservative with him and really not in any hurry to push anything. And now they're going from five innings in an instructional league game to pitching in a major league game. What has changed, or has anything changed in that time?
Well, it's not official that he will pitch, and I think a lot of it depends on how he feels today when he comes into the ballpark. But I think the situation has changed in a way. and probably not in the way that the Yankees would hope. Look, they've got 13 games left. It's looking like they're not going to go to the postseason. So there's less pressure to say, Tanaka, save our season, come out and really just go full bore and make one or two starts and then be ready for the playoffs. Now the situation has changed where maybe he's just going to come back and throw five innings and kind of get his work in against major league hitters. So I think that actually in a strange, perverse way, the fact that they're falling out of playoff contention may make it more likely that Tanaka would pitch and they can worry less about the results.
So in a sense, not only the results, but that he maybe puts a little less pressure on himself and maybe doesn't feel – maybe doesn't get too far ahead of himself or try to do too much?
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that, look, they're going to look very closely at him. He's a huge investment. You're basically talking about his future here. If he needs a surgery, you're knocking him out probably for all of next year. And if he can rehab it and get through it and stay on the mound, then you can realistically pencil him in and say that Tanaka will come into spring training and be in the rotation for opening day. So obviously that's what the Yankees would prefer. They don't want him to have the surgery because then you're looking at him coming back in 2016. But, yeah, if he can come back and show them that he can get major league hitters out with whatever he has now, then I think an offseason rest can only help.
The Yankees are making their last trip this year to St. Petersburg, and that means it's the last time down there for Major League games for Derek Jeter. It's a lot of places. There have been a lot of stops. There have been a lot of these. He's been fed at a lot of places. But it seems like this is one of the bigger ones. Fenway is going to be a big deal. Obviously, the last home game is going to be a big deal. We had an item from Adam Berry on Yankees.com this week about this. Tropicana Field is not a place that's often romanticized, but this last series in St. Pete is really a big deal for Jeter, isn't it?
I think, personally speaking, it is, yeah. Derek was talking a lot about that yesterday, and Adam did a good job with that story about how he came down here and was working out in 1994 to try and get better and make it to the big leagues, and he was miserable here. He hated it. He was homesick. He missed being home. He was on the phone every night. He was crying. But he has, in time, come to really love Tampa, and this is home for him now. He makes his off-season home here. He built a huge place out on Davis Islands. This is where he's going to retire. This is home for Derek Jeter. So, yeah, no, I think that he probably won't miss a whole lot about playing baseball at the Trop, but he'll miss the getting in the car and going to Starbucks and having his little commute to the ballpark and being able to sleep in his own bed and then go play in a big league game. I think those are things that Derek Jeter's going to think about. And obviously spring training, too. This is the Yankees' home. He spent a lot of time here, a lot of time on those fields. And really, when you tell the story of Derek Jeter, I think that Tampa and St. Pete is a huge part of it.
We talked about this, I guess, a week ago with the Jeter day at Yankee Stadium. But we're now down to a week and a half left, and the reality seems to be growing much heavier that the odds are very strong that September 28th will, in fact, be Derek Jeter's last Major League game. I don't want to keep harping on this, but at the same time, I think it is a big deal. As that gets closer and closer, and as that reality becomes bigger and bigger, do you see any difference in how he's carrying himself, how he's going about things, taking any extra time or anything, or is it really still the same day by day as it was 3 months ago?
I think it's pretty consistent, yeah, especially – it's the same as it was 3 months ago. I don't think it's the same as it was 2 years ago. But I think this whole farewell season for Derek, even though he doesn't want to call it a farewell tour because the idea was to get to the postseason and play in one more postseason, I think that now that the standings look the way they do, I think it's going to shift a little bit, and it's going to create the opportunity where he's going to want to take a step back and try and appreciate all of it. And I think he has been, but when you're in the middle of it, when you're fighting for playoff position, when wins are so desperately needed, I think that it's hard to step back and look around and see what's going on. So I hope he can absorb it. I think it's pretty cool, everything that's been going on this year, just the same way it was last year with Mariano. I think that Mariano tried to absorb as much of it as he can, but I think you're always going to have something lacking there. I don't think you can soak 100% of it in because it's just flying by so fast. And that's the one thing. Derek was looking at the calendar earlier this month, and he said, my God, September already. It just flew by. And so I think that the year has really gone quickly for Derek. I think that probably went a little quicker than he thought it would. So I hope he's been able to appreciate it because there's been a lot of cool stuff going on.
From the baseball side, Carlos Beltran just missed another few games and then came back again. It sounds like he's going to have surgery this winter. What do you see, what's your understanding of what that's going to mean for him over the winter and next spring?
Yeah, the Yankees don't seem too concerned about it because, I mean, players have had bone spurs before. It's an old bone spur that has just started to bother him a whole lot this year. But they said it was pre-existing even before he signed the contract. So I think that as soon as that last game of the year is in the books, he can have it immediately. He can schedule the procedure the next day if he wants to. I think he'll do it as quickly as he can because I think he wants to get it behind him. And I think in a way Beltran's looking forward to it. So he'll rest for 2 months. And so if he has it in October, that'll take him probably to the beginning of December. And then he can start throwing and swinging a bat again. And really shouldn't be too much of a problem. And the Yankees seem to think that he can come back and be closer to what he was in St. Louis and that this year this can be a one-year aberration. Because, look, this is not the Carlos Beltran that they paid $45 million for, so clearly you hope that the last 2 years of the deal will be better than the first one.
And that actually leads into my next question. What do you think can be expected? I mean, this has been a really rough year for him at the plate and a guy that I think – didn't want to be a designated hitter. And what do you think is reasonable to expect from him, both performance-wise, but also playing the outfield next year?
Yeah, we've seen Carlos Beltran at his best. This was not a Carlos Beltran year. He hated being a designated hitter. He really wants to be in the outfield every day. And I think it's important for the Yankees that they can. They could barely play him in the outfield this year. The way the roster is constructed, you know, Beltran can have some at-bats, a designated hitter last year, and I think it's a good option to rest him. Obviously, you won't have Jeter coming back, but remember, Alex Rodriguez is going to come back, and he's going to try and play third base, and I think he's going to need a lot of time at DH as well. So if Beltran can be counted on as a corner outfielder, you can put him in right field on a regular basis. I think that's going to give Girardi a lot of flexibility.
Right. That really was the other issue there, it seems to me, is that there. It's hard to see where there are going to be any at-bats for him at DH next year. It seems like there's a real problem there if he can't play the outfield.
Yeah, and Teixeira's going to need some time at DH too. I mean, this is the thing with these players past 35 in long-term deals. They just can't be counted on to play 150, 155 games in the field. So, yeah, no, Beltran's going to have to come in. He thinks that he's going to have no problem throwing. Obviously, they try to get him ramped up and throwing again. Kept having setbacks with it. This is really just something that he's going to have to go in, get cut, and have the doctor fix it. And, you know, he should be able to come back and be a productive major league player. I don't think that this year, Carlos Beltran 2014, is what the Yankees are going to get in 15 and 16, but we'll see.
Well, Brian Hoch, thanks for taking some time here to chat on MLB.com Extras. Talking Tampa Bay Rays with MLB.com's Rays beat reporter, Bill Chastain. Bill, it's been a few days now, but not too long ago, the head of the front office, the principal owner of the Rays, Stu Sternberg, said that it looked like the payroll next year is going to be down some. This is never a franchise that splashes all its chips around, but what do you think that exactly means as far as the roster for 2015?
Well, it means they probably will try to look a little bit leaner. And one thing funny about Sternberg, even at the start of this year, he was a little bit nervous being a favorite. He kind of likes being the underdog, but if you look, you know, from the top, you're cutting prices $14 million to start, so you're going to have a pretty good head start. But I think where it gets sticky is where you've got some of the guys who they have signed for next year, and if they try to get rid of them or if they are keeping them. You know, for example, if you got Grant Balfour, who's not had a good year, he's making $7 million. You've got Jose Molina, who's making $2.75 million. You've got David DeJesus, who hasn't had a bad year, but he's making $5 million. And then you've got options on Peralta and Zobrist. And you know, that might be one of the deciding factors in whether or not you keep a Ben Zobrist. He's got an option for $7.5 million, and you just got Nick Franklin, who we're going to see this week. In fact, he should get his first start tonight as a Ray after finishing out the year with Durham in the International League playoffs. But, you know, I was thinking about it. It might be a deal where Franklin and Forsythe end up sharing second base next year. They've already said they like Franklin best as a left-handed hitter. So, you know, he might have to win some confidence in order to see lefties.
Well, that was why I thought – you kind of touched on why I thought that was such an interesting set of remarks, was that it kind of looks like this team's more or less set for next year. You know, I think you've talked about, we've talked about on here, that this team was not built for 1 year. It was built to be sort of together for a little while, to have a core that would last more than just 2014. So I guess that's kind of what I'm wondering is, this doesn't necessarily mean major surgery, does it? It just probably means
not at all.
Trimming around the edges.
It could be some of the, you know, periphery pieces. You know, I mean, they got a couple of players who were arbitration eligible. You know, Matt Joyce made 3.7 this year. Sean Rodriguez 1.4. You know, how do these guys fit in? Desmond Jennings, you and I talked about him some last week. He's arbitration eligible for the first time this year. Do they keep him? You know, the outfield is kind of in flux a little bit. It feels like there's not really anything really set. On the bright side, if you're a Rays fan, the core of the team, which is the starting pitching, you know, which is the lifeblood of the team, is really looking, this past week, I think it's even looked stronger than it has all year based on the fact that Nathan Kearns came up and gave a strong game. And then you saw Alex Colome last night, what he did. And, you know, they're even thinking about if, you know, they'll probably default to, if Colome doesn't make the starting rotation, he'll probably be a new bullpen weapon. I mean, he throws 95, 96. So, you know, the lifeblood of the team is there in that starting group. And then, you know, you got to figure that somebody like Ryan Hannigan is going to give you more next year. Some of these other guys are going to rebound. So I think I think you could be pretty optimistic looking at next year, and particularly the fact that the AL East is not really, you know, since I've been covering the team, it's really not exactly the highest bar you've seen in the AL East.
It's definitely true. The rotation, as you mentioned, and really the pitching staff as a whole, seems very deep. If they needed to cut corners, not cut corners, if they needed to do some trimming, are there internal options offensively? Are there guys on the farm offensively who might be able to step in and fill some roles? Or is it more just that those guys are already on the roster and might be asked to do more?
It's probably guys on the roster asked to do more. And you know, I get people email me all the time asking about why they don't trade for a power bat. The bottom line is there just aren't a lot of power bats out there to be had, and particularly for what, you know, the pay range and what they want to look for. I know, you know, it seems like the winter meetings every year, someone tries to take a flyer on a guy who's between, a $4 to $8 million guy, and, you know, you might get a big up. You might have a big upside on him, but there's also the chance for, you know, a good downside. And I think the Rays approach, the way they finally decided to just kind of rotate the DH, you know, and mix guys in and out and give them a night off, just like Longoria was out last night. You know, I just think that's the way for their particular model. I think that's the way to go. And other than that, you know, you just don't see a lot of offense to be bought.
Yeah, it's one of the guys that you touched on a little while ago that I'm very curious to see is Nick Franklin. He was, in some ways, maybe not if the centerpiece, certainly one of the key pieces in that David Price trade. What do they want to see from him? Admittedly, it's a very short stretch here, but what do they want to see from him? What specifically are they looking for as he gets a few at-bats here down the stretch?
I just think they want to, you know, get a better feeling about what they got. I know they pretty much were smitten with him when they first, you know, he had a very nice series against them last year when he was at Seattle, and I'm sure they scouted him extensively. You know, he's a Florida kid, you know, from, high school in Florida. So I'm sure they have a pretty good dossier on him to begin with. You know, everything I've heard, he has a great upside. You know, they're just, you know, maybe a little bit more maturity. Who knows, maybe he got that this year in the minor leagues. I know he did quite well in the playoffs, hit over 400 for him. So, again, I think it's going to probably come down for him, not a matter of whether he makes the team, just a matter of whether or not he, you know, he's a switch hitter, whether or not he's going to start hitting against lefties too, because, you know, right now they say the left side is the strong side.
And the other part with him that you also did just mention is the Ben Zobrist situation. Look at the numbers. It's been a real rough go here for Zobrist the last 6 weeks or so. You never want to make too much of a rough stretch for a good player, but you look at a guy who's getting into his mid-30s and has that kind of down stretch at the end of the year. Does that play in at all when they look at whether to hold on to him and pay him next year, or whether they decide to go another direction at second base?
Well, first off, I'd be very surprised if they didn't pick up his option. And then, you know, I do know from talking to enough scouts that there's plenty of teams that covet this guy. So if they decide to go another direction, I'm sure there would be plenty of suitors to take over. But the big thing to remember about him is this guy is a starting player who can play a lot of positions. It's not like your father's utility player, you know. I mean, this guy is a starter who just happens to play a multitude of positions. So I think he's very valuable to any team. And even though they've got Escobar now at shortstop, you know, it's always nice to have that luxury to have a major league shortstop you could plug in there if something happens to Escobar, which has happened, a couple times in the past 2 years.
Do you think, though, that this stretch here is just a slump, or do you think it's – because it's really 2 years in a row he hasn't been – again, he's a very good player, but hasn't been quite up to the levels of the past. Do you think that we're starting to see a little bit of decline from this guy? And if so, I got to think an organization like the Rays follows the old you'd rather trade a guy a year too early.
Now, I would agree with your latter comment there. As for the former, I have no way of really knowing if he's in a decline. Sometimes – when an offense is doing bad as a whole, I think it's tough to judge an individual player. So, I've heard some of the guys say maybe he is too much up there for a walk, or too much of having a quality at bat, and maybe needs to be a little bit more aggressive. But, you know, I have no way of telling that. But I definitely would agree with you on the fact that the Rays are prone to make their mistakes or make a move on the front end instead of after the fact.
Sure. All right, well, Bill Chastain, thanks for taking a few minutes here on MLB.com Extras. Talking Boston Red Sox with MLB.com's Red Sox beat reporter Ian Brown. Ian, Dustin Pedroia underwent wrist surgery recently. It doesn't sound like there's a great deal of concern. It sounds like this is considered relatively routine. With that said, I'm of the opinion that wrists and hitters are always scary. What's your understanding of what happened here, what the prognosis is, and what kind of the winner looks like for Pedroia?
Yeah, Matthew, the surgery itself isn't a big concern because, like you said, it's a relatively minor procedure, not that uncommon. He should be fully ready to go for the start of spring training. That's why they wanted to shut him down for the last couple weeks of the season and get this done now. The thing that's concerning is that he's had continual hand injuries the last 2-3 years now. In 2013, he had a head first slide into first base at Yankee Stadium on opening day. And basically, in typical Pedroia fashion, played through the whole season with that. You know, a lot of people would have shut down and had the surgery and been out 6 weeks. But he played and it really cost him his power. I think he hit 9 home runs last year. And then the same thing this year was in the home opener against Milwaukee on a takeout slide. You know, he tumbled down and sort of re-injured that same hand. And again, sort of just like he does, sort of stoically played through that. And again, he had, you know, not the power we were used to seeing from him. Not that he's ever been a 30 home run hitter, but Pedroia, one of the reasons he's always been so valuable, he's a guy who can hit you 15, 20 home runs, you know, from a second baseman, from a number two hitter in the order. So that's the big concern, that these hand injuries kind of keep happening to him. And, you know, hopefully they can nip this in the bud now, and he can have a year kind of like the year he really hasn't had since 2011, when he was really one of the top hitting second basemen in the game.
Is the club confident that it really was just a matter of not being healthy this year? Because there is some history. Second basemen tend to be a little like running backs. They can go quickly. He's 31. I'm not suggesting he's done by any means, but is the club confident that this down year was just a matter of him not being healthy all year, or is there some level of worry that maybe this was the start of a decline in the position, where decline can come early and swiftly?
Yeah, you know, I think that they're hopeful because they do have reasons for the decline in the numbers in both last year and this year, where there was clear-cut hand injuries. And as we all know, hands relate directly to hitting. So I think they'd be more concerned if they saw a completely healthy Dustin Pedroia not be able to, you know, hit the ball out of the ballpark or off the wall. But again, 2 years in a row, it's basically happened in the first five games of the season, and he's played through it all year. So I think that because, you know, this guy works as hard as any athlete I've ever seen, and he's just you know, he's one of those guys, I think, much like we talked about with John Lester at one point, I think he can be an outlier about the whole, you know, the whole age thing because of just how hard he works and how seriously he takes his craft. So I don't think they'll be concerned about a real decline in Pedroia until he has a completely healthy year where he doesn't, you know, he doesn't produce. You know, I think the question is, you know, can he stay healthy? I think that's probably the bigger question right now.
The other thing, not to nitpick, because it was always sort of a bonus for a guy who's such a complete all-around player, but he ran a lot this year. Is that one thing you do kind of maybe expect to see as he gets into his 30s? Maybe he goes from a 20-25 stolen base guy to a 10 stolen base guy?
Yeah, I think so. I mean, you try to conserve those legs as long as you can. And, you know, the place they really want his legs and his speed and his quickness are on defense, because I really haven't seen much of a decline there, if any. You know, he's a really, really, really good second baseman. I think, you know, his defense might have been overlooked even a little bit over the years because of just how good he is offensively. But he's, you know, still one of the top 3 to 5 second basemen defensively in all of baseball. He has the Gold Gloves to prove it. So, yeah, if you're going to, you know, if you're going to cut down on some wear and tear by not having to steal as much, I think that's fine. I don't think that's a huge part of his game or a huge part of, you know, the Red Sox success.
And that does lead into my next question, which is, you know, I don't see these guys every day. I certainly try to watch as much as I can, but you see them every day. The defensive numbers are as good as they've ever been, and in fact, by some measures, this has been his best defensive season. Does that match up with what you've seen with your eyes, that he is as good as, if not better than ever, defensively?
Yeah, I mean, this guy is the total package on defense. I mean, he makes a play every day, just about every day, where it leaves you shaking your head. Makes a spectacular play, makes a routine play. He's as good at turning the double play as there is. So, yeah, I think that those defensive metrics you mentioned, they're dead on from what I've been watching the last 2-3 years.
And while he's out, another kind of interesting thing happened here, which is that the Red Sox moved Mookie Betts over to be the guy to take that spot while Pedroia is out for the remainder of the year. Now they're saying his long-term future is in the outfield. Is there any way, I mean, he's obviously not going to take the second base job long-term unless Pedroia is hurt, but is there any way that his future is somewhere other than center field?
Yeah, I think it's, you know, Mookie Betts is the type of athlete where he can play just about anywhere. So, yeah, I think that there is a chance. I think he's really a guy they're keeping their options open to see how their roster is constructed for next year. But I think for the last, and the real short term, I think that this Pedroia injury allowing Betts to go to second base, that's erased a little bit of a problem for them, because I didn't see how in the last 2 weeks of the season they were going to be able to fit in, you know, Ruzy Castillo and, you know, Jackie Bradley Jr. and Mookie Betts and get everyone the at-bats they need and keep getting these evaluations that they're looking for. And now, you know, you put Betts at second base, so that opens up, I think Ruzy Castillo will get to Pittsburgh on Wednesday to make his debut for the Red Sox. So you can just pretty much put him out there most of the time and see, you know, get a little taste of what you're going to have from him, and also keep Mookie Betts playing every day.
Is Betts a guy that maybe plays multiple positions long-term? I'm just kind of get a handle, because he's a guy who has kind of come out of nowhere, you know, a year ago, the center fielder was Jackie Bradley. Heck, 3 months ago, the center fielder was Jackie Bradley. And I do just kind of wonder, if you're grooming a guy to be your center fielder, it seems like, especially if he's not a center fielder by trade, you want him getting all the innings out there he can get. And I realize they're filling a need, but they're also filling a need on a team that isn't going to the postseason. So is there some is the plan, again, less obvious than maybe just he's center fielder? You mentioned the versatility. Is it as interesting as it looks from outside, I guess, is my question.
Yeah, I think it is, because, look, the Red Sox have a lot of roster flexibility right now going into the offseason, because they have several guys who can play a few different positions. And, you know, this is why Kevin Youkilis was so valuable for a long time, because he can play first and third, and Theo Epstein back in those days could be really sort of open-minded about what he was going to do. You know, that one year he went and got Adrian Gonzalez, and he could just move Yuklis over to third base. It's kind of similar with Mookie Betts, where he could play all over the diamond. And in a worst-case scenario, if all the spots are filled on this year's roster, you know, you make him a super utility guy, you know, until a spot opens up for him. So, I think that he is a guy that has that athleticism where he can play all over the field. So I don't think you necessarily have to lock in a position for him right now. I think you need to see how they get through this offseason, what trade chips they need to fill their needs, kind of who's left, and then go from there.
Yeah, one of the other topics we've talked about a couple of times recently is Koji Uehara. He's back on the mound this week. He had a decent inning. Where does that stand? Did he look sharper? Did he look more like what you're kind of expecting to see? And how does he fit in over the next 2 weeks and, more importantly, I think, beyond this year?
Yeah, I think that the rest was good for him, not just physically but mentally. This is a guy who puts a lot on himself. And when he's not performing up to the way he expects or the way other people expect, he really takes it hard. And I think that he needed that break. He looked pretty good the other day in Kansas City. And I think the plan right now is to get a few more of those low-leverage situations. And I think the last week of the season, you kind of put him back in there the ninth inning to see how that looks and to see if he's a viable option to be their closer next year. I still think that they would love for him to be their closer next year because they know what he brings to the table. They know what he does when the pressure is at the highest. And I think that their A plan right now would be for Koji to be closer next year. I think that they're pretty confident they can re-sign him, but they just want to get a little look at him the last week of the season to make sure that he's not in full decline right now, which has happened before to 39-year-old pitchers.
That was going to be my next question. Are they pretty confident that if they want him back, he wants to be back there?
Yeah, I mean, he's become really comfortable here in Boston, and I think that this is a place that he would love to finish up his career. And I think that they've had some talks with him, and obviously by not trading him like they traded a bunch of other guys at the trade deadline, I think that they were kind of showing how much they believe in him, and I think that meant something to him at the time. So I still think there's a pretty good chance that Koji comes back next year.
I want to talk about one more aging and maybe even you might say aged key Red Sox player. A month ago, David Ortiz was hitting .245. He had a .337 on base. It wasn't looking like a real good year. Since then, he's had one of those months that he has. He's now up to the kind of numbers that fit right in line with where he's always been. Can this guy keep doing this? How long can he keep doing this?
It's like we've been waiting for him to sort of drop off for, I think, 2 or 3 years now. And he keeps doing it because, one thing I think that, you underestimate is that he doesn't have the same wear and tear as a regular player because he's not playing any defense. His job is to hit 4 or 5 times a day. He works awfully hard in the weight room, doing what he does to stay ready. So right now, I can't see him just, it seems to me he's still going to be a pretty productive player next year. I think if David's really enjoyed this last month because he's had Cespedes hitting behind him. And I think at this point, David would like to not have to be the guy. He'd like to have somebody else who's comparable to him behind him, and I think that's what they're going to do. I think as long as they surround him with the players like Cespedes and maybe they can go out and get another bat this winter, then I don't see any reason why he can't keep producing at a pretty good level. I'm not going to say he's going to hit 35 homers and drive in 110 every year, but David Ortiz is hitting 20 to 25 home runs and driving at 90 at the age of 39, which will be next year. I think that's still a pretty good player that a lot of people would like to have on their team.
Can you see him having a Giambi-like tail to his career and maybe sticking around for a couple of years even after he's a full-time guy and kind of being pinch hit leader kind of thing? Or is he a guy where when he's not really a star anymore, he probably just hangs it up?
Yeah, I think that he probably just hangs. It reminds me of a quote that Tom Brady had last week when he said, look, he said, when I start to suck, I'll retire. And I thought that was a great line. And I think that, David would be of the same mindset. I don't think he's done enough in this game. Or I don't think that he's going to feel the need to be out there just getting 175 or 200 at-bats for a key pitch hit. I think he'll be happy with all he's accomplished in his career and, right off to the sunset and just be Big Poppy, another facet of life somewhere.
Well, as a fantasy player, we can revisit that Brady issue another day. But Ian Brown, thanks for chatting ball here on MLB.com Extras, and thanks, everybody, for listening.